Well, it's back to school time for most of the United States, which means everyone's attention is turning away from summer fun and back to the old grind of learning. But if you've been listening to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, Part 2 Palooza all summer, then you've essentially been taking a history class. So, good for you! You've learned how to have fun and receive an education simultaneously. I suppose that was the goal of the Oregon Trail. The game, not the actual Pioneer Trail, and has been for all the versions of it from day one. Back in April, I spoke with Dan of the Tracing the Path podcast to learn about the origins of the game and see what it can tell us about the past. Not necessarily the 1840s, but the 1960s and 70s and beyond. Here's part two. Oregon Trail holds a place in the hearts of Gen Xers and Millennials right next to Choose Your Own Adventure books, as each experience gave a certain level of control to young people while staying within the confines of history or an established fictional plotline. And we tend to place these two pieces of popular culture in and around the same time period, the late 70s, because that is when Apple II, upon which so many games of Oregon Trail were played, was introduced, and when The Cave of Time by Edward Packard was published. Giving children agency in their studies and storytelling is an informative indicator of the era. But learning about its origin place and early development, we can see that the push to encourage critical thinking and media literacy in children was a growing priority in the mid-1960s. You mentioned before Choose Your Own Adventure. I wouldn't be surprised, and my wife is a librarian, so I should ask her. But and she's a huge fan of Choose Your Own Adventure books. But that also would not be a surprise to me if the first of those was being written around the same time, because it seemed like those the mentality, if I'm, you know, of the baby boomer generation of like, hey, wouldn't you know it, kids, their youth, their upbringing, their education, that's important, right? That's a very important time in your life. It's a critical time in your life. And their parents were treating them, you know, thanks in large part to, you know, new psychology about, you know, childhood, you know, Dr. Spock, which for the longest time I always thought was a Star Trek guy, but, you know, Dr. Benjamin Spock was writing about how to properly bring up children, and, you know, treating them not as just little adults, but, you know, giving them a childhood and educating them at every, but also letting them play and, you know, all those kinds of ideas. By the time you get to the 70s, that is now on to like the second generation of that. The baby boomers are starting to have their kids. And so those mentalities are being, you know, kind of passed over to them, where it's like, you are important to us and you getting the most out of your education is important. And we also have you, you know, so every way that we can to get you thinking about things, you know, new ways of learning, we're behind it. We like this idea. But I would have never guessed Minnesota. I always just kind of assumed that Silicon Valley, California was like, that's the ground zero for computer and, you know, and technology. But the location of where this all came from, I think is, I think a lot of folks, I'm sure I'm not the only one that's like kind of surprised by that it was Minneapolis, Minnesota, not somewhere else that all of this computer revolution was taking place.
Yeah, that's a, you know, somewhat progressive place. You know, it's a mill town and a mining town, and they got the Mississippi River that starts, you know, just north of Minnesota or Minneapolis. You know, that was a good place to be for a long time, and still is if you really like snow.
Yeah. But, you know. it has, like, the... I think that's what most people just kind of associate with Minnesota is cold and snow and not really like, and like, you know, maybe the Mighty Ducks. Like that's pretty much like the most people.
You got 3M. 3M's maybe the most innovative company in the world. You know, every project manager, 3M has to have 76% of their portfolio has to be less than 3 years old. You know, they're always trying to come up with, they're the notepad people, the sticky note people, the, you know, the different kinds of things you hang on your wall so it doesn't rip the paint. You know, they do a lot of stuff. And then Spam happens to be from Minnesota, as the Jolly Green Giant. Nabisco, Pillsbury, and all these big milling companies. That's a pretty big city. You know, they've got 3 million people just in Minneapolis itself.
Oh no, but because it's not on either coast, I think that's one of the reasons why it kind of falls outside of people's just general knowledge of it. You know, it's like it's not as flashy as LA or New York. You know, it doesn't have that kind of appeal. But this just proves once again that, you know, that's why I actually added that question onto my form a few years ago, because I always come from the point of view that geography has a huge factor into people's behavior and what they do.
Definitely.
Bigger than almost anything else. So like where it's made and then the locations associated with it. So I don't mind, if you don't mind, we can chip away at that a little bit more, because when it goes from, you know, obviously the Oregon Trail, that's a location or several locations associated with this, but also when did it really start to, I would say early 80s must have been when Oregon Trail and Apple together became mainstream across the whole country. Every state, every school had at least one computer in libraries. I remember playing Apple IIe at the public library when I was a kid. You know, in the children's room, they had one computer set up and you could sign out a time to play, you know, Face Maker or Number Cruncher or Muncher.
There's been a couple of funny moments during this for me. Because I can tell that I'm older than you. Even the idea that you said, you know, you used to play Oregon Trail at the computer lab. What's funny about that to me is when in fourth grade, in 1983, there was one computer, and it was on one of those rolling carts, and the rolling cart was pushed from classroom to classroom. And when you said computer lab, I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's a different. That's like a few years down the road when schools had more than one computer. And I think maybe the fourth grade had one and maybe the sixth grade had one. And I remember playing those. And at the time I lived in Alaska. I lived in Anchorage. And even when I was doing this research long ago, just thinking to myself that in 1983, the school board in Anchorage, Alaska bought computers for the classroom with the mech software, like, you know, that period of time, that huge period of time, 82, 83, 84, you know, that was enormous for the country in terms of, I mean, I was coming home from school talking about being on a computer to a family that had no computer. Like, just that concept, like, you were doing what at school?
Right.
Like, our generation is the first generation to have computers in the classroom where our parents aren't even sure what it is that we were doing, because that wasn't part of their world. So it wasn't until a few years later, and for me it was probably 5 years later, that we got a Commodore 64 computer, you know, which is like a competitor to Apple. But before that, there was no computer in my house. Like, I was the person bringing the concept of computing into the family, which now doesn't exist. Now you hand iPhones to 18 months old and they know how to play with them.
Right. They pick it right up. I have that conversation with my students all the time at Dover, right. With computers, because I teach a pop culture class, and it's no wonder to me that the movie, The Terminator, came out in 1984. Because it speaks directly to the fears that people were having of, you know, those who are completely blindsided by how much computers just took right off and were fearful. And now I look at things like AI and almost specifically AI. I'm like, maybe they were onto something as far as being worried about this, you know, because I make the point, there's been a Terminator movie every decade since 1984, like 1980s, where in every time it shows up, it's a commentary on the relationship between man and machine, man and computer at that time. So I was actually, just before we got on, I did a podcast last week. I released one anyway about Terminator 2, the Terminator 2 video game. And so I'm like, hey, it's been a while since I've seen Terminator 2. It's one of my favorite movies. I'll just turn it back on again. And that movie came out in 1991. So just before the internet really went commercial and became, you know, such a big part of people's lives. And it has, that one in particular has such an important message about humanity and, you know, the, our relationship with technology and stuff. But 84's did too. I mean, that one really just screams people's biggest fears of their kids coming home from school and talking about these machines that they were operating on. And it's like, okay, you know, we laugh now when we look at the capabilities of the Apple IIe and, you know, the games that were being played back then, you know, but for somebody who was completely a novice or had no relationship or understanding of computers, I could see why that would produce, you know, a worrying, you know, train of thought that would be like, okay, one day these things are going to come back and literally haunt us, you know, they're going to come after us, you know, kind of thing.
You know, the internet was not even a blip on the radar in 1984. Wasn't even a concept really in any of our minds.
Yeah.
But that was also the year of the Los Angeles Olympics in the United States.
Yep.
And it just so happens that at the Los Angeles Olympics was basically the first time that an email system existed. The athletes, somebody created a hub and spoke type model for athletes where they could go to a kiosk, they could type in a password and load something up, and they could send a message to other athletes.
Huh.
And it was the first time that that concept had even existed as well. Sending,
like, I'm going to beat you in the next race.
Data.
Yeah. Like, good luck. I'm going to, you know, throw the javelin farther than you.
That was 84.
Yeah. I wonder what, and also 1984 is when Apple introduces the Macintosh and they have that commercial with, you know, the Olympian type, you know, woman running through and she throws the hammer into the screen. You know, Orwell's 1984, being spoken to there. I mean, it's just amazing how it's all, you know, that's like the watershed year. That's like the moment. It's like there were other moments. Now, do you think, was there any recognition, any nod by any of the people involved with this computer revolution, this home computer revolution, of the irony that the game that really seemed to be launching it, especially into schools, was about pioneers, because they themselves are pioneers in the world of home computing? Did they recognize that? Be like, oh, you know, Oregon Trail, it, you know, that's an interesting title to have for us introducing, you know, and blazing this path, this brand new path.
Well, I think as a trailblazer, I think trailblazer is a term you can only use in a reader's. Because I think as you are doing whatever it is that you're doing, and, you know, for Minnesota, they're making some software, they're putting computers in classrooms, but do they have the knowledge in their head that they're blazing a trail for the future? Like, that's, it's almost like, well, this is the task that I'm doing today.
Right.
So I've never even heard, and I don't know if you know this, but after my episode of the Oregon Trail came out, I got a phone call from Don Rawich, who created the Oregon Trail, who said he'd heard the episode. And I was actually at the pool at the time, and I told my wife, I was like, you are not going to believe who is on the phone. You are not going to believe this. But he didn't even have that concept, that that idea that, you know, making a game about trailblazers is a trailblazing activity to do. Like, that wasn't part.
But I'm curious about the Jobs and the Wozniak guys, you know, the Apple guys, you know, because that's the game that did it for them, right? That's the one that said, this is where we're going. And it's almost, I wonder if they were like, you know, if it had been any other game, would they have had that same reaction? Or if it was just like, the timing was perfect.
Yeah, and I think for them, it was more the concept of Mech has a software subscription service.
Mm-hmm.
Inside of it is a game that every kid wants to play and they learn from.
Yeah.
But otherwise, if you buy our computer and you subscribe to the Mech software service, you know, your students are going to have everything they've ever needed, and your teachers are going to have more help in the classroom. Right now, they're asking for assistance. They're asking for other teachers to come in, but they're going to have an instant teacher in the back of the classroom.
Right.
And the MEC computer software actually made so much money over time that the state had to spin it off into its own company. The state of Minnesota, they're like, we don't need to fund this anymore. It's making more money than we can handle. So they spun it off into its own thing, and they eventually spun it off into a private company, which in 1995, 10 years after the big push, it was purchased for $370 million.
Whoa.
By a company called SoftKey. And the guy running that company is a name you might remember or you might know, Shark Tank's Kevin O'Leary.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
Yeah. Bought that game. Bought MEC. So yeah. I thought, wow, that's cool. And then they ended up revitalizing it. They made a new computer games out of it. They made games for the Brother computer system.
I remember Brother.
You know, they turned it into something much bigger. And then at some point in time, the original Oregon Trail game became part of the Video Game Hall of Fame, which the three guys were there to receive that award. And there, in their speech, they said, you know, we made this game while we were at Carleton College for 8 days. And then Don Roberts said, yeah, then I retyped it, you know, once to get it into the system. But never did they own it or make a dime from it, which I always thought was interesting.
So they were like grimacing as they're accepting this award.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
thanks. We get this honor, you know. Which is funny because that's in Rochester, New York.
The Strong Museum.
That was where my wife is from that area, and she has very fond memories of playing Oregon Trail in her own school years. So much so that she a couple years ago bought this little, and I was looking for it before we went on today to show it to you, but she bought this little handheld version of Oregon Trail, but it looks like somebody took an Apple IIe and just stuffed it down to handheld size. It has, you know, that off
nice
whitish green, you know, yellow color to it. Looks like there's a smoker in the house, you know, when you're playing this thing. And, you know, the little green images came up, and it could operate Oregon Trail just fine. And that was it. But she, you know, I think a lot of kids growing up in the 80s have that, you know, very fond memories of playing that game because, you know, when it comes to the actual game itself, if we look at that, it gives kids, and this is what I was saying about the you know, choose your own adventure books too, it gives kids choices. You know, that's not something,
yep.
And this is also the same time period, you know, late 70s, early 80s, that Nickelodeon is arriving on the scene. And Nickelodeon had come from a revolutionary, or at least an attempt to make a revolutionary TV program or TV station called Cube, which allowed for viewers at home to interact with what was on their screen. So if they wanted to see something, or it was like early American Idol type stuff, they could vote on things using these boxes and stuff. And that was out of, you know, Columbus, Ohio. So, you know, not a big TV town. And so the offshoot of that was Nickelodeon, and the early days of Nickelodeon were kind of, you know, shaky. They didn't seem to get their footing just right, as far as the kind of programming that they had. And then, you know, almost like an identical story of like, they were just kind of like collecting as much stuff that they think kids would like. And then they finally found, that, you know, you can't do that on television show from Canada, which gave the kids the agency that they'd been looking for, right? That kids were in charge of that show, right? They were the ones who were the main cast members, and all the adults on You Can't Do That on Television were jerks or forgettable or pushovers, or, you know, the kids were in charge. And that transformed that entire network. I mean, Nickelodeon adopted the slime. They adopted, you know, the format of a kid-centric thing. And so it's just like, that was the world. And Oregon Trail, Choose Your Own Adventure, that gave, you know, because kids didn't have absolute power in their households. But in these moments, in your own classroom, when you're on the, you know, bus ride, you know, home from school, or when you get home from school, if you have the book, you know, Choose Your Own Adventure, you can actually make choices and you can follow and put yourself, as Paul Harvey said, in the main character, you know, and you can see yourself. And I think that's such a unique thing to that era. It's not unique anymore. It just definitely has turned into a greater expansion of that. But for that time period, it was, I think all of this was just a reflection of that individualism trickling down to children as well, that they were part of that, I want to make my own, choose my own destiny kind of attitude, that this computer revolution and media revolution in general, I guess, was all part of one big wave.
Yeah, dude, the whole thing is crazy. I don't even know if you know this, but you remember Howdy Doody from the 50s?
Yeah.
Steve Jobs remembers when he was a kid, Howdy Doody had this episode or a few different episodes where you got some sort of a clear cling, and you put the cling onto your computer screen or your TV, and then Howdy Doody would do things and you could trace a path on your little cling.
Oh, yeah.
And this moment he remembered as a child is what he brought up when he told the people at Apple that he wanted to create something where you could touch the screen. He wanted the screen, which became like the iPad. But, you know, the iPod concept, he wanted you to be able to integrate with this or interact with the screen. And it all came from an early TV show.
Which, you said it earlier that the original computers, like the ones that Oregon Trail first was generated on, was just printed. You know, it was, there was no monitor.
I looked at it.
And I'm curious if, you know, obviously TVs and monitors, especially early computer monitors, well, they've always just kind of looked the same. You know, there's rarely, you know, there. And so I'm curious if there was ever any thought, and you might not have the answer to this, but I'm just thinking out loud. I wonder if there was ever any thought by the people involved in computing, in computer technology, of anything else besides a TV looking thing that would be the way that most humans would interact with the computer. Cause when you look at those 60s computers, you know, those room size computers, you know, they're pulling out drawers and there's cards in there and there's like readings coming out on dials. Like it looks nothing like what we know as a computer, like the microchip, you know, was years away. And so they weren't, there was like, that was not going to happen. I wonder if there was any other choice besides a TV monitor, or if that's what was it because of experiences like what you just said, where, you know, those as children, those computer guys, the guys who revolutionized the entire computer industry, were like, yeah, I remember watching Howdy Doody and having this, you know, special way of being able to interact with that. And, you know, I want to see that into reality. I mean, it's almost like Star Trek of the early 60s has inspired countless.
The Star Trek movie came out in 1979 at the same time that the Disney's movie, The Black Hole, came out.
Huh. So they were like competing.
Same month, in fact.
And the original movie or the original show just inspired so many people. Like our cell phones are directly from, you know, and like I remember watching a program one time on History Channel where they just talked about Star Trek tech and how,
how much did it predict?
Right. And not only, and it predicted it because the viewers, you know, usually like younger people, you know, I'd say Star Trek's main audience is probably teenagers and a little bit older, maybe a little bit younger around there, but they were of that age where they're, you know, almost like the Jurassic Park effect, you know, when you get into the early 90s, the young kids of that age, how many of them grew up to be paleontologists? You know, they're like, I was so captivated by that, I want to pursue, you know, so people watching Star Trek might pursue astrophysics, or they might pursue computers, or they might pursue telecommunications because of what they're inspired by seeing on media and pop culture. And so, you know, we could be playing our computer games, Oregon Trail, on some kind of projection, or, you know, we could maybe still have it rolling on a piece of paper. Imagine that, if our computer revolution now was, you know, still using paper as a way to get the readings out. We'd be ridiculous right now. But, you know, it's just, it's those little tiny, you know, kind of drops along the way that make all the difference. The ripple effect is just like, astounding. And that's exactly where your program picks up. So, I think we covered, even if it wasn't, you know, systematic, boom, 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 all the way down the line, we covered pretty much everything that my program demands, that we cover. I think there's just, you know, as far as like the one question that I sometimes skip over on my shows, because most pop culture is, in most art, is very prescriptive. You know, it's meant to just kind of give you a thought or an idea or think a certain way. So that's why I don't usually cover it. But in this case, I will, because prescriptive versus descriptive. How accurate, as much as a black screen with, you know, green lines can be, but the gameplay itself of Oregon Trail, how accurate to describing history was that game? I mean, because
Don Rawich prides himself on having read lots and lots of Oregon Trail diaries.
Okay.
At the time, in order to get it right, in order to ask the right questions, in order to get the right feel, he read a ton. And, you know, there's the Dillabaugh diary, if you're familiar, is probably the biggest one. And that was written by a family from 1865 to 1879, I think. Which is, you know, kind of like, it's basically the Civil War era.
Yeah.
While they're doing the Oregon Trail, the Civil War is going on in another part of the country.
Yeah.
And in that, in their diary, it was pretty much everyday life, you know, that he tried to transfer into the questions that went into the game.
Yeah.
And in fact, what was interesting to me is I'm currently doing another episode about Halley's Comet. And in that diary, the family mentioned seeing Halley's Comet and a partial moon. What is it called? In this, or eclipse on the same night. And they remembered waiting at an airport for who's the flyer? Charles
Lindbergh, yeah.
Lindbergh. They remember seeing the Liberty Bell that was being taken around the country on a train. So all these different things were inside of these diaries, including the hunting and how much money they had and how much food they bought for the family. And all of that stuff he tried to put into the game to be as realistic as possible, because in his mind it was an education opportunity to what life was like on the Oregon Trail and not like what life should have been like.
Right. First of all, talk about one of the many things you can do with a primary source collection. In this case, a diary entry is, you know, that's a pretty much a standard primary source. Like somebody who's writing it as they're experiencing it. So when we get to look at it, we totally get where they're coming from. And we can, you know, see that as a document of the time. And so to do something with that, like, all right, I'm going to turn this into a game. I'm going to, you know, pass the torch on to the next generation, you know, of learning about this era. That's great. But then also it seems to fit in with this fascination with that era of westward expansion that had consumed the country for a good part of the 20th century. I think about the Little House on the Prairie books, you know, because, and coincidentally, Minnesota is where Laura Ingalls' family starts, you know, Little House in the Big Woods, you know, starts in Minnesota or, you know, Wisconsin. You know, that part, and then they move, you know, steadily further west for Little House on the Prairie. And those books are not, they kind of like, they don't really have much of a plot line. It's more, it almost reads like a diary. It's her, you know, and Laura Ingalls, Wilder herself, is incredible life. I mean, she, her first mode of transportation is a stagecoach. And then by the end of her life, she's flown on an airplane. And everything else in between. And so
speaking of that, Charles Lindbergh is from Minnesota.
Yeah. Oh, and so there it is again. I actually just want to throw this, not a name drop or anything, but I met Charles Lindbergh's daughter a few years ago.
Nice.
Reeve Lindbergh. She was the youngest. She was born long after all of the, you know, transatlantic flight and, you know, the terrible thing that happened to her, would have been her older brother, but he, you know, that whole kidnapping thing had actually had taken long before she was born. But she, I mean, you wouldn't even guess Charles Lindbergh's child. Like, she was just like another nice senior citizen woman. And I had the opportunity because it was at a library, and we got to ask questions, and I asked her, actually, I said, you know, what did, because her father was a consultant with the movie, The Spirit of St. Louis. And I said, and I think he was still alive, obviously, when they finished it. And I'm like, how close did they get to reality with? And she said, you know, he did have some hangups of it, but overall, he thought it was a pretty good representation of how he went through it. But then one of the things I was, I have a picture of myself doing this. I'd found it at some thrift store a couple years before. I have this commemorative plate from like the early 30s of Charles Lindbergh flying over the Atlantic, and, you know, like those commemorative plates they have. And I presented it to her. I said, hey, have you, she's like, I've never seen one of these before. I've seen everything else. I've never seen this one. So I have a picture of me with her taking, you know, holding the plate, which is really cool. And so, yeah, it's like, you know, I love how these things just go around, but I guess what I was getting at eventually was with the fascination with pioneers, and he's another one, but pioneers and pioneering, it makes sense in the 70s that this thing would kind of gel together and they had a TV show, Little House on the Prairie, because, you know, 1976 is the bicentennial. It's, you know, and people, especially after Watergate and Vietnam, were just grasping for any kind of source of pride and patriotism in the country's history as we approach the 200-year mark. And so it's like, it's no wonder that the TV version of Little House on the Prairie, even if it's not even close to being accurate to the books, was a huge hit in the 70s, as was Oregon Trail, as was, you know, countless other tales of everything that's happened in American history in the last 200 years. You know, so like, it all fits together. It's all just nice little puzzle now that we've done it together. This has just been a joy to be able to talk to you about this. And where can people best find you and your program, Tracing the Path? Just wherever you can find podcasts? Do you have any other landing areas online?
Yeah, Tracing the Path is wherever you listen to podcasts. It might make it to YouTube this year if I can get an animator on board.
That'd be great.
But otherwise, I'm Dan R. Morris on everything. Twitter, mostly Twitter and Facebook, I guess, because I'm
okay. But, it's funny. You know. I think everybody seems to have their choice social media outlets. Like I'm on Instagram the most. I do some Facebook, and I don't do any Twitter.
Exactly.
And it's like it's kind of like whatever your forte is.
And then my kids go with it. TikTok and Snapchat, and they don't care about Facebook and Twitter at all. So.
Yeah, Facebook's old news to them, right? Yeah. They don't, you know, like, who has a Facebook, you know? But so that all those places is where you can be found. I think that's where we met. That's where we crossed paths because
indeed.
There are ever-growing communities of podcasters all over Facebook. So it's a great place to exchange ideas and come up with what we have here. And that's a nice guest opportunity. So I really can't thank you enough for taking the time. And just to complete the story that I said before, real quick, when we were talking, getting, you know, texting back and forth, listeners, what we did was we found out that, and I found out through listening to one of your episodes that not only had you lived around the same area, the seacoast of New Hampshire that I live in and grew up in, but I teach at the school that Dan went to school in. So, well, in the short, I'm like, talk about tracing the path. That's like the perfect, I'm like, but then I think about the computers and the algorithms. I'm like, maybe the AI had a little bit of, you know, putting maybe, us together. Maybe. Maybe it brought my thing to you because it knew that you had that connection. But anyway,
I'm just excited to share the episode with my alumni group.
That's cool. Yeah, we're going to definitely have to do that. And so, Dan, thank you very much for joining the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. And thanks for everybody for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything, including Oregon Trail, not the trail, but the game, is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time. I hope you've been enjoying the second halves of the second half of season 2 of the EPS podcast. We have one more to go, and then season 3 will start shortly thereafter. In the meantime, don't forget to like, share, follow, review, 5-star the podcast, and follow the show on social media, especially Instagram. Be sure to go over to everythinghistory.com. That's everything-history.com to learn more about my offerings and to keep up with the podcast there too.